the natural law. Some actions of man are according to right reason, and others are opposed to it. On account of the relation between parent and child, right reason tells us it becomes a child to show right reverence to its parents. On the other hand, hatred and ill treatment of one's parents is opposed to right reason. Conscience tells us, moreover, it is our duty to love and reverence our parents, and we ought to do so, and we are bound to do so, thereby making known to us the will and precept of a superior, the will and command of God, the author of nature, and our Lord and Master. He cannot be indifferent as to whether we follow the dictates of right reason or not. He necessarily, as he is good and holy, wills that right order should be observed by us. The rules of conduct which right reason manifest to us, our conscience, the voice of God, commands us to follow, constitutes the natural law, which is a participation of human reason in the eternal law of God, willing that right order be observed and forbidding it to be disturbed. The object, then, of the natural law are all those actions which are conformable to or not conformable to rational nature. They are actions which are necessarily prescribed because they are demanded by human nature, while on the contrary, they are necessarily forbidden because they are contrary to the demands of human nature. They are good or evil not merely because they are forbidden or commanded by lawful authority, but because in themselves they are becoming or unbecoming for man to perform, because human nature is what it is. As rational human nature remains substantially the same, and its essential relations do not change, it follows that the duties which the natural law imposes on man do not change substantially either. The natural law, then, in itself, is universal and unchanging. It binds all men at all times. However, it does not follow that the natural law is everywhere and equally known. And again, St. Thomas Aquinas tells us under question 34 of the Summa, further, nothing that is natural is a sin, for sin is a wandering away from what is according to nature, according to Damascene. Now a vice is contrary to man's nature, inasmuch as he is a rational animal, and when a thing acts contrary to its nature, that which is natural to it is corrupted little by little. Under question 71, St. Thomas quotes St. Augustine saying, whatever is lacking for a thing's natural perfection may be called a vice. And he goes on, every vice, simply because it is a vice, is contrary to nature, as St. Augustine says. But it must be observed that the nature of a thing is chiefly the form from which that thing desires its species. The man derives his species from his natural soul, and consequently, whatever is contrary to the order of reason is, properly speaking, contrary to the nature of man as man. While whatever is in accord with reason is in accord with the nature of man as man. Now, man's good is to be in accord with reason, and his evil is to be against reason, as Dionysius states. Therefore, human virtue, which makes a man good, is in accord to man's nature, forasmuch as it accords with his reason, while vice is contrary to man's nature, insofar as it is contrary to the order of reason. Then one of those who were present at the Catholic doctrine class said, some of these things you have just explained, Father, about sin and the natural law and the eternal law and God's laws, are covered very well in the book titled The Church Speaks to the Modern World, which contains information from the writings of Pope Leo XIII. And you have told us before, Father, that we should read these encyclical letters of the popes, because these holy fathers explain and expound on what the Catholic Church teaches us in writing encyclical letters and then their bulls. And I read here in this book that contains, when God created the world, he himself saw and said that his works were very good, Genesis 1:31. They were such because they had been created in accordance with the infinitely perfect intellect and will of God. A general consequence of this is that what we call the law of nature is just a particular expression of the divine law. And just a little ways down that page, it goes on to tell us, one of the most fundamental laws of nature is unequality. Stones are less perfect than plants. Plants are less perfect than brutes. Brutes are less perfect than man, who exists as the stones, lives as the plants, feels as the brutes, and moreover, exercises intellectual knowledge according to his intellect. Even within the human species itself, individuals are unequal, both physically and intellectually. These inequalities and imperfections entail as their necessary consequences other inequalities in power and in authority. Since this is the way the world has been created by God, it is how it should be, and any attempt on the part of man to subvert the natural order of the created universe can only result in catastrophes. It is one of the most constant teachings of Pope Leo XIII that to deny the natural laws which govern societies is to court disaster. The same truth could be expressed differently in saying that overlooking the sacred character of the law of nature is one of the main sources of the evils that threaten modern societies. To rebel against the order of nature is not the way to change it. God alone, who gives to rulers their authority, can take it away from them before the appointed end of their lives or of their constitutional tenors. Naturally, since they hold their authority from God, rulers should not be obeyed when their orders are contrary to the law of nature or to the divine law. Moral liberty presupposes the existence of laws and their recognition by the human will. Since all these laws are finally reducible to the divine law, which prescribes good and forbids evil, the true liberty of man ultimately consists in obeying the divine law. There could be no such thing as that of thinking anything, of saying anything, of writing anything, of teaching anything, and of maintaining every conceivable position about every possible subject. The true meaning of the criticisms of these so-called modern liberties is not that there are no such liberties. Rather, it is that these liberties consist in the firm resolve only to think, to say, and to write that which is true, and only do well that which is good according to the prescriptions of the natural law, of the human law, and of their common source, which is the divine law. The only reason there is to tolerate evil is the care of the common good. What is to be condemned is the tolerance born of a complete indifference to the true and the good. Rightful tolerance only tolerates evil, recognized and denounced as such, in view of the common good. What the Church cannot possibly do is to declare satisfactory a school regime based upon the principle that anybody should be free to teach what it pleases him to call truth, even though it may be error. A widely spread conviction may happen to be false, and we know that it is so. Only we do not like to think that this applies to the opinions of our own times. Man indeed is free to obey his reason, to seek moral good, and to strive unswervingly after his last end. Yet he is free also to turn aside to all other things, and in pursuing the empty semblance of good, to disturb rightful order and to fall headlong into the destruction which he has voluntarily chosen. And a little later on, the book continues, it will suffice to quote his subtle commentary in the words of our Lord, quote, whosoever committeth sin is a slave of sin, unquote. Everything, St. Thomas says, is that which belongs to it naturally. When, therefore, it acts through a power outside itself, it does not act of itself, but through another, that is, as a slave. But man is by nature rational. When, therefore, he acts according to reason, he acts of himself and according to his free will, and this is liberty. For as, when he sins, he acts in opposition to reason, is moved by another, and is the victim of four misapprehensions. Therefore, whosoever committeth sin is the slave of sin. Even the heathen philosophers clearly recognized this truth, especially they who held that the wise man alone is free, and by the term wise man was meant, as is well known, the man trained to live in accordance with his nature, that is, in justice and virtue. In man's free will, therefore, or in the moral necessity of a voluntary act being in accordance with reason, lies the very root of the necessity of law. Nothing more foolish can be uttered or conceived than the notion that, because man is free by nature, he is therefore exempt from law. Were this the case, it would follow that to become free, we must be deprived of reason, whereas the truth is that we are bound to submit to law precisely because we are free by our very nature. For law is the guide of man's actions. It turns him toward good by its rewards and deters him from evil by its punishments. Foremost in this office comes the natural law, which is written and engraved in the mind of every man. And this is nothing but our reason, commanding us to do right and forbidding sin. Nevertheless, all prescriptions of human reason can have force of law only inasmuch as they are the voice and the interpreters of some higher power on which our reason and liberty necessarily depend. For, since the force of law consists in the imposing of obligations and the granting of rights, authority is the one and only foundation of all law, the power, that is, of fixing duties and defending rights, as also of assigning the necessary sanctions of reward and chastisement to each and all of its commands. But all this, clearly, cannot be found in man, if, as his own supreme legislator, he is to be the rule of his own actions. It follows, therefore, that the law of nature is the same thing as the eternal law, implanted in rational creatures, and inclining them to their right action and end, and can be nothing else but the eternal reason of God, the Creator and the Ruler of all the world. From this it is manifest that the eternal law of God is the sole standard and rule of human liberty, not only in each individual man, but also in the community and civil society which men constitute when united. Therefore, the true liberty of human society does not consist in every man doing what he pleases, for this would simply end in turmoil and confusion and bring about the overthrow of the state, but rather in this, that through the injunctions of the civil law, all may more easily conform to the prescriptions of the eternal law. Likewise, the liberty of those who are in authority does not consist in the power to lay unreasonable and capricious commands upon their subjects, which would equally be criminal and would lead to the ruin of the commonwealth. But the binding force of human laws is in this, that they are to be regarded as applications of the eternal law, and incapable of sanctioning anything which is not contained in the eternal law, as in the principle of all law. Thus, St. Augustine most wisely says, I think that you can see, at the same time, that there is nothing just and lawful in that temporal law, unless what men have gathered from this eternal law. If, then, by anyone in authority, something be sanctioned out of conformity with the principles of right reason, and consequently hurtful to the commonwealth, such an enactment can have no binding force of law, as being no rule of justice, but certain to lead men away from that good which is the very end of civil society. Moreover, the highest duty is to respect authority and obediently to submit to just law. And by this the members of a community are effectually protected from the wrongdoing of evil men. Lawful power is from God, and whosoever resisteth authority resisteth the ordinances of God. Wherefore, obedience is greatly ennobled when subjected to an authority which is the most just and supreme of all. But where the power to command is wanting, or where the law is enacted contrary to reason, or to the eternal law, or to some ordinance of God, obedience is unlawful, lest while obeying man, we become disobedient to God. And a little further on it continues, there could be no doubt that truth alone should imbue the minds of men, for in it are found the well-being, the end, and the perfection of every intelligent nature, and therefore nothing but truth should be taught, both to the ignorant and to the educated, so as to bring knowledge to those who have it not, and to preserve it in those who possess it. For this reason, it is plainly the duty of all who teach to banish error from the mind, and by sure safeguards to close the entry to all false convictions. Now truth, which should be the only subject matter of those who teach, is of two kinds, natural and supernatural. Of natural truths, such as the principles of nature and whatever is derived from them, immediately by our reason, this as on a firm basis, morality, justice, religion, and the very bonds of human society rest. And to allow people to go unharmed who violate or destroy it would be most impious, most foolish, and most inhuman. The right to command and to require obedience exists not only so far as it is in accordance with the authority of God, as is within the measure that he has laid down, but when anything is commanded which is plainly at variance with the will of God, there is a wide departure from this divinely constituted order, and at the same time a direct conflict with divine authority. Therefore it is right not to obey. When this reading from the works of Pope Leo XIII were finished, the catechumen said to us, "It seems to me that anyone who breaks the commandments of God and the natural law breaks the eternal law of God and thereby commits a sin." And I replied, "Yes, that is true." And that is why Pope Leo XIII also writes in his encyclical against the Freemasons, "The eternal law commands the natural order to be maintained and forbids it to be disturbed." And then another person at the Catholic doctrine class stated, "I can see more clearly now why His Excellency made the decision that smoking is wrong. Can you explain that in any more detail?" So I answered, "Yes, with God's help. To do that, let us go back to the Catechism Explained and read what it says under the fifth commandment of God. In the fifth commandment, Almighty God forbids us to destroy our own life or that of our neighbor, or to treat the lower animals with cruelty. Our body was created by God to be an abode for our immortal soul. The condition of the soul is often dependent upon the condition of that abode. When God made the human body out of lifeless earth, it was an uninhabited tenement, but it was destined to be inhabited. Therefore, God created the soul to be its occupant. St. Peter speaks of his body as a tabernacle, which he would shortly have to quit, 2 Peter 1:14. It fares with the soul, and the body as with the inmate of a house. If the house be unhealthy, the dweller in it falls sick. Our body is like the shell of an egg. If the shell be injured, the young bird within is hurt. So if our mortal frame sustains injury, the spirit, the noble inmate of that dwelling, suffers with it. The Romans had a proverb, a healthy mind and a healthy body. Our body is not our own. It belongs to God. 1 Corinthians 6:13. It belongs to God not only because he created it, but because Christ purchased it with a great price. 1 Corinthians 6:20. We are bound to take care of what is the property of another. The tenant of a hired house has no right to damage or destroy that house. So we are not at liberty to injure or destroy our body, the abode of the soul, created by God and belonging to him. We must not do with our body what we will, but what God wills. Our body is an implement of the soul, entrusted by God to our keeping, to be made instrumental in amassing merits for eternity. Like all other instruments, our bodies can be misused. Hence, St. Paul warns Christian people not to yield their members as instruments of iniquity unto sin. Romans 6:13. As God will require us to give account in the manner in which we have employed the tenets given us, so we shall have to answer for the employment of the body, which the soul informs and makes instrumental in the performance of the duties of our calling. Our Lord told St. Gertrude that after the resurrection, on the members of the body employed in his service, surpassing dignity and excellence would be conferred. Since the life and health of the body are of great importance for the life of the soul and for our eternal salvation, we are bound to take precautions for the preservation of our health and of our life. By means of cleanliness, temperance, regularity, industry, and the use of remedies in case of sickness. Health is worth more to us than vast riches, Ecclesiasticus 30:16. For the longer we keep our health and our life, the more treasures we can lay up for eternity, where neither the rust nor moth doth consume, where thieves do not break through nor steal. If we thoughtlessly do anything to shorten our life, we defraud ourselves of a part of our seed time. The eagle takes the utmost care of its egg, not for the sake of the shell, but for the young eagle enclosed in the egg. So we should take care of our body because of the soul that dwells within it. Cleanliness is to be observed in our persons, our apparel, the rooms we inhabit. Temperance in eating and drinking. Abstemiousness promotes health and prolongs life. See what has been said on the advantages of fasting. Many men of weak physique naturally have so increased their strength by abstemiousness that they have been capable of immense activity. St. Paul in his epistles often mentions his bodily weakness. Regularity is to be observed in regard to meals, the time of going to rest, and rising in the morning, in one's work and in the arrangement of one's time. Above all, let us never be unemployed. By work, we may not only earn our daily bread, but do much towards keeping ourselves in health. Work circulates the blood and gives an appetite for food. Stagnant water becomes foul, and the blood of the idler is apt to get into a bad state. Yet we must not overtax our strength with work. Moderate labor invigorates. Excessive toil ruins the powers of our body. Finally, it is our duty to have recourse to remedies in case of sickness. It is sinful, if anyone is dangerously ill, not to call in medical aid and employ remedies. Honor the physician for the need thou hast of him, for the Most High hath created him. Ecclesiasticus 38:1. The Most High hath created medicines out of the earth, and the wise man will not abhor of them. Verse 4. However, if the cure is too costly, or if it involves acute suffering, it may be forborne. Furthermore, we are under a strict obligation to do nothing that tends to destroy health or life. Consequently, it is a sin to rashly hazard one's life, wantonly to injure one's health, or to take one's own life. Some persons are in the habit of injuring their health by indulging to an excess in amusements, by vanity in dress, and partaking too freely of unwholesome food. And therefore, we should be able to see that by putting together what the Catechism teaches and what St. Thomas Aquinas and the other doctors of the Church teach and what the popes have taught, that everything that is contrary to the natural law is contrary to the eternal law and is a sin. To the natural law belongs everything to which a man is inclined according to his nature. And among these, it is natural for man to be inclined to act according to reason. No man can dispense from the divine and the natural laws. The eternal law commands that the natural order be maintained and forbids it to be disturbed. So it becomes very obvious that our bodies are not our own. It belongs to God, and we have no right in any way to destroy it. And so it should be very clear that smoking, which obviously injures the health, is forbidden and morally wrong. One of the people in the Catholic doctrine class then asked, well, if smoking is morally wrong, why do so many people still smoke? Someone else let us read an article before the class began, and now I will try and relate some of the facts in that article to you. Cigarettes and tobacco. In 1964, the report of the Surgeon General's Advisory Committee on Smoking and Health once and for all laid to rest the myth that tobacco smoking is a harmless and at times beneficial habit. The medical establishment had long suspected that smoking was a direct cause of cancer, lung disease, heart and arterial failure, and a number of other illnesses. But most previous studies had been considered inconclusive. The fact that an agency of the United States government had publicly declared that smoking was a menace to public health was front page news, and the report quickly became the story of the year. Alarmed, hundreds of thousands of cigarette smokers immediately gave up the habit, and the number of cigarettes sold dropped from the first time since they were rationed during World War II. The United States Public Health Service and the American Cancer Society began an all-out campaign to publicize the dangers of tobacco smoking and offered suggestions to those who were trying to stop. Cigarette advertising was eventually banned on television and radio, and cigarette packages were required to carry the warning, quote, may be hazardous to health, unquote. Later, the warning was strengthened to read, quote, smoking is dangerous to your health, unquote. A month after the Surgeon General's report was issued, retailers began complaining that cigarette sales had decreased by as much as 30%, and that their livelihoods were being threatened by the anti-smoking campaign. Their fears proved to be unfounded, however. For several months later, cigarette consumption climbed back to its pre-1964 levels. Having spent millions of dollars trying to educate people with brochures, billboards, newspaper and magazine advertisements, radio and television commercials, and lectures, the Public Health Service conducted a survey to find out what had gone wrong. In interviews with a cross-section of current male smokers, the Public Health Service was surprised to learn the following. 71.3% agreed that smoking is harmful to health. 59.5% hoped that their children would never smoke. 57.7% agreed that cigarette smoking is a cause of lung cancer. 54.6% agreed that smoking is a dirty habit. 44.9% agreed that there is something morally wrong with smoking cigarettes. Clearly, the anti-smoking crusade had gotten their message across to the people they had hoped to reach, but with little effect on actual smoking. That the spirit was willing, but the flesh weak, was all too apparent. And that's all I'm going to read from the article just now, because there is the whole answer in a nutshell. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. They know it is wrong, but because they're already addicted to it, or because many others are doing it, they just go along with the crowd. They're not willing to deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow Jesus crucified, and live the faith. Rather, they are willing to remain slaves of the devil by remaining slaves of their addictions. And then someone else in the Catholic doctrine class said, "Wait a minute, Father. The things you've been saying about smoking, don't they equally apply to the other bad habits? With regard to things that are addictive and things that destroy health, I was told there is an encyclical written by Pope Pius XII against smoking. And I happen to have another encyclical from a book sold at Mary Immaculate Queen Center, in which Pope Pius XII is writing with regards to human nourishment. And therein, Pope Pius XII condemns the use of these artificial enrichments, white flowers and such like things. And Father, you have to admit that there is probably at least as much, if not more, literature on the market today that explains the evil effects of white sugar, enriched flowers, drugs, and the things they put in these soft drinks. It can be much more harming, although maybe not as apparent in the beginning as smoking, but those things certainly destroy the health. Why is that not morally wrong? Is it not against reason to do those things which your conscience tells you destroys your health? And you told us, Father, that we should base our life on what the saints, especially the popes and the fathers and the doctors of the church, teach us. And did not St. Thomas Aquinas, the Prince of Theologians, teach us under question 71, when he quoted St. Augustine, "Every vice, simply because it is a vice, is contrary to nature"? But it must be observed that the nature of a thing is chiefly the form from which that thing derives its species. No man derives his species from his rational soul, and consequently, whatever is contrary to the order of reason is, properly speaking, contrary to the nature of man as man, while whatever is in accord with reason is in accord with the nature of man as man. Now, man's good is to be in accord with reason, and his evil is to be against reason, as Dionysius states. Therefore, human virtue, which makes a man good, is in accord to man's nature, for as much as it accords with his reason, while vice is contrary to man's nature, in so far as it is contrary to the order of reason. And under question 34, St. Thomas tells us, "Now a vice is contrary to man's nature, inasmuch as he is a rational animal, and when a thing acts contrary to its nature, that which is natural to it is corrupted little by little." So, how can you get around the obvious truth? If you do those things which are contrary to reason in destroying your health, from whatever means unnecessarily, you are acting contrary to reason. You are destroying your nature. You are injuring God's property. You are doing that which the Catechism tells us is a sin to do. Are we permitted to break the commandments part of the time and observe them only part of the time? Jesus Christ said, "If thou wilt enter into life, keep my commandments." Why don't we teach and observe the commandments all of the way? And so then I answered the catechumen, "About all I can say to you is the same thing that was stated with regards to the smoking problem. People who are rational and honest with themselves, it seems to myself, would be morally obliged to admit that it is evil to smoke as a habit and to do it unnecessarily. But that still does not change the facts. Although smoking is evil, because of fallen human nature, many people still do it because of their addictions to this corrupted way of living, contrary to God's laws and commandments. It is certainly not difficult to find many other people who will injure their health by putting other poisons into their body besides just smoking. They will always try and justify it and say the church does not teach what the moral theology really does teach. They do not want to properly apply the catechism, what the saints and the fathers of the church teach us, because then they would have to overcome their fallen nature and start living according to God's commandments. Rosalie, at this time on the original 5-hour tape, I went into a kind of lengthy discussion about devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus and some of the things taught in that regard in the Community of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. But because I've already covered that quite sufficiently earlier on this set of tapes, who is right and who is wrong, I'm not going to go through that part. Although on the 5-hour tape I did give some other quotes from the popes and so on, but if what has been said earlier in this set of tapes does not convince people, then no need to repeat it. They probably won't be convinced anyway. So I'm going to just pick up on the 5-hour tape after I finish the section on devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus and to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And there are many other things which the people we tried to instruct and work with could see were going wrong, not only with regards to devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus and these other things that have been discussed. They can see that things are falling apart and quicker all of the time. The merry-go-round is just spinning faster and faster. A lack of organization and a lack of getting messages out, a lack of running according to the laws and schedules laid down by nature, a lack of not being able to go to Mass because you do not know when and where there will be a Mass, a lack of consideration of even having a Mass on Sundays and holidays of obligation because the Mass was not offered at the time and place it was scheduled to be offered, so people actually missed Mass on those days. But we're not going to discuss any more of those things. So as one of those priests on the merry-go-round, of which I've spoken about earlier on this tape, I began to pray much more seriously than ever before and to think about what this was all leading to and what it should mean in our lives. I believe that total consecration to Jesus Christ, the incarnate wisdom, through the Blessed Virgin Mary would be the answer and solution to all of our problems if we lived it. And knowing from the booklet written by St. Louis Marie de Montfort that if we take that consecration and do not live it, it will become a poison to us and cause us to have a deeper place for our eternal damnation. But if we some way live that total consecration to Jesus through Mary, that will answer the problems and teach us what is right and what is wrong, and obtain for us the actual graces necessary to live a life keeping God's commandments, and thereby enter into eternal life. So we open up the book, True Devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary by St. Louis Marie de Montfort, toward the back where it speaks of consecration to Jesus through Mary. We find that the object of this consecration is to cast off the spirit of the world, and that then, as you probably already know, is the first step in becoming a slave of Jesus through Mary. Renouncement of the world. St. Louis Marie de Montfort writes on under these 12 preliminary days, the first part of the preparation should be employed in casting off the spirit of the world, which is contrary to that of Jesus Christ. The spirit of the world consists essentially in the denial of the supreme dominion of God, a denial which is manifested and practiced by sin and disobedience. Thus it is principally opposed to the Spirit of Christ, which is also that of Mary. It manifests itself by the concupiscence of the flesh, by the concupiscence of the eyes, and by the pride of life, by disobedience to God's laws, and the abuse of created things. Its works are first sin in all its forms, and then all else by which the devil leads to sin, works which bring error and darkness to the mind, and seduction and corruption to the will. Its pomps are the splendor and the charms employed by the devil to render sin alluring in persons, places, and things. If you take and think about that and really apply it, you see then that disobedience to God's laws and the abuse of created things is going on very frequently. Every day, it seems, it is a way of life. Instead of renouncing the world, we have more and more, it seems, embraced the world. For the moment, just forget about what other people think and say, and answer your conscience in truth. Even if you don't completely accept what the popes and right reason tells us about destroying our health, not following God's natural laws, not living according to nature, for the moment, just try to open up to grace and accept that for what it is, according to your right reason. And then you will see why error and darkness have come into the mind, and why there is such a seduction and corruption of the will. In other words, the spirit of the world are the pomps and the splendor and the charms employed by the devil to render sin alluring in persons, places, and things. Think these things through from that point of view once, and I think you will understand the most basic point of why we have so much confusion in our minds, possibly, because it will certainly take away much of that misunderstanding of the eternal truths, if you will admit to what the eternal truth himself teaches us. Then we go on to the second step of knowledge of self. To understand this second step better, we read a selection from the book Learn of Me by Father John Kearney. Self-seeking, in the strict sense, can never be lawful, can never be orderly, because self-seeking means seeking what suits ourself without reference to God and without due dependence on Him. Self is the moving power of our activity. We seek and rest in self as our end. This involves ignoring the full meaning of the fact that we are God's creatures. Remember all those parables we preached? How we stressed that we are God's creatures, and when we refused that, we are nothing but a self-seeker. But if we seek something that suits us, something that gratifies us, because this seeking is according to the divine will, then what we do is good. For example, reasonably seeking food. In reality, this is not self-seeking, but seeking to please God. Thus, we can choose the recreation that we like when we know that it is God's will that we recreate ourselves, provided the recreation we select is reasonable. Disorderly self-seeking rests on self-advantage as an end. Orderly seeking for what suits us makes self-advantage to be a means to God. To put this in a few words, we must seek to possess God and all that leads to God. If we do not seek God, we are naturally led to seek ourselves. The wrongness of disorderly self-seeking is in the fact that it ignores the full consequences of the truth that we are absolutely dependent on God. Hence, we may define self-seeking as a practical refusal to live in total subjection to our Creator. God has appointed an excellence which He desires us to seek. This excellence is possession and the development of that divine grace which makes us His friends and His children and leads us to His kingdom. It is therefore our duty to seek this supreme excellence, to strive to advance in grace, and we can also seek whatever helps us to this excellence. But all this must be done in the way appointed by God. From this it is manifest that to seek an earthly excellence or gratification, which is not a means to grace, is inordinate self-seeking, because we are both seeking a false excellence and pursuing it independently of God. It is also inordinate if we seek to advance in grace in ways not appointed by God, but chosen by ourselves. This again is obvious self-seeking.